I am speaking with Tim Bartik. He's an economist with the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research here in Kalamazoo. We are discussing what we know and what we don't know about right-to-work laws. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
What does economic research say about right-to-work laws and their effect on economic growth and jobs?
Well, frankly, and unfortunately, the empirical work's all over the map. You can find good studies that find that right-to-work laws increase the manufacturing share of employment and good studies that find no significant effect. You can find good studies that find that right-to-work laws reduce wages and good studies that find that they don't. So, unfortunately, the research points in many different directions.
Is there reason to believe what I think would probably be the conventional wisdom, that if there is a right-to-work law, you would have more jobs, but those jobs just may not pay as well?
Well, from a theoretical point of view, what you would expect is that right-to-work laws would be particularly attractive to firms that are relatively labor-intensive, relatively low wage, that would not want a union because they'd be concerned it would increase labor cost. And you would think that it would have therefore some effect, for example, on lower wage manufacturing jobs. At the same time, you would expect the major effect would be on the mix of jobs, because if you're not attracting low wage manufacturing jobs, that means there are more industrial sites and more labor available for other companies to come in. You're more attracted to other companies because you have more available land and labor. In addition, there would be some direct effect on wages from right-to-work laws, not just by affecting the mix of jobs, but also by weakening union power. It would affect wages both at unionized companies, and an important point, there would probably be some spillover effects at non-union companies, so-called threat effects. We know from the labor economics literature that one spillover effect of unions is that potentially unionized companies may raise their wages to avoid being unionized. So we would theoretically expect right-to-work laws to have some effect, increase the mix of lower wage jobs, particularly in manufacturing, but at the same time to have some negative effect on wages. Unfortunately, we're not in a position to give a point estimate. What percentage change would we expect to see in manufacturing jobs? What percentage change would we expect to see in wages? Because there might be a trade-off there. It might be you get more low-wage manufacturing jobs, but that the overall wage rates and per capita income go down.
What are the factors that, when you try to look at this as an economist, make it difficult to just tease out exactly the effects that right-to-work laws are having on job growth and wages?
Well, the biggest problem is that there's not enough variation in right-to-work laws. And, of course, right-to-work laws, we're not doing a random assignment experiment where we took the states in the U.S. and randomly assigned half of them to right-to-work laws. That's the first problem. The second problem is that there's not a lot of variation in this. Historically, right-to-work laws were mainly in a number of southern states and a few western states. And more recently, there have been a couple states that have adopted right-to-work laws, but not that many. So you don't have that much variation. And within a state, it's just a 0-1 variable. It's just you're either a right-to-work state or you're not. There's not variation across industries in the variable. In addition, the political climate that leads to the passage of right-to-work laws tends to be a political climate that leads to many other changes. It tends to be a political climate that leads to lower business taxes, reduction in government regulation of businesses, many other changes. And so trying to separate this out. So the reason why you get up with these dueling studies, it depends upon what you control for or what you look at. So, for example, you sometimes hear people say, well, gee, right-to-work laws, right-to-work states grew more rapidly since World War II than non-right-to-work states. Well, the right-to-work states were in the South.
And the South grew.
The South grew tremendously. You know, most regional scientists, regional economists would say that a lot of that had to do with, you know, air conditioning became widespread. It made it much more attractive, both for manufacturing and for people to live. You also have the move from rail and water transportation to truck transportation, which made manufacturing more footloose, so it decentralized. You know, I think the civil rights movement and the revolution played a role. And there are a host of things. And but the point is, in general, you can, you know, if you want to, you'd find a correlation between how fast states grew and what percentage of people in the state were fans of the St. Louis Cardinals, Atlanta Braves, and the Alabama football team. Those would all be correlated with state growth, yet we wouldn't think those are causal factors. So, you know, this is not an easy topic. You can't simply look at right-to-work states versus non-right-to-work states and say, gee, there's some difference in average growth rates, or for that matter, wage rates. I mean, the same thing goes on wage rates. We know that a lot of the southern states are low-wage states. You can't necessarily attribute that purely to right-to-work laws.
Now, as you say, most of these right-to-work laws have been in southern and some western states. Indiana joined the right-to-work state group recently. And that was one reason that Governor Snyder gave for putting his support behind right to work, whereas in the past he had said it wasn't on his agenda. Is there any good research about, you know, states that border each other and whether or not jobs move across the border because one state is right to work?
There have been states that specifically look at border effects, and they do find some of the studies find some border effects on the percentage of manufacturing jobs. However, those studies don't find effects in bordering counties, don't uniformly find effects in bordering counties on manufacturing growth rates or in wage rates. So there's some evidence that there are some border state effects, but the magnitude of those effects is disputed. One study, so you have two very good studies that differ in their magnitude on 3-to-1 in terms of the magnitude of the effects they find.
Is there some reason to believe in economic research that if you simply create more jobs, even if those jobs start off at a lower wage, that eventually that volume of jobs creates a situation where it becomes a better market for people seeking jobs, and therefore wages eventually do come up?
Well, obviously at some point that's true. I mean, if you create a sufficient number of jobs, that will, by driving up the employment rate, driving up demand for labor, will tend to increase wage rates. But if at the same time you're having a lower wage mix of jobs and lower wages for jobs because of lower unions, it's unclear whether even in the long run that would fully counterbalance it. I mean, this is why it's a little frustrating that we don't have the precise estimates we would want, because it really is a question of magnitude. If we knew for a fact that a policy would raise employment by quite a bit and it only had a modest, very small initial decrease in wage rates, I think you maybe could argue that in the long run it might pay off, as you were suggesting. But on the other hand, if the policy only has a moderate increase in jobs and has a very large negative shock to wage rates, it's not at all clear that even in the long run that the job growth will make up for it. In the case of right-to-work laws, as I said, the estimates all over the map. We can't give precise estimates. You know, we think that there's probably some mix of some effects on attracting some lower wage manufacturing jobs, but on the other hand, it tends to lower wage rates and may on net lower per. There's at least several studies find that it lowers per capita income, and even in the long run. So I think, frankly, we can't say definitively how that all adds up. If your bottom line is, for a policy, does it raise standards of living? For right-to-work laws, we don't know how that trade-off plays out. There's certainly no strong evidence that it raises standards of living. So if people are trying to claim that, there's no strong evidence that it does. But, you know, on the other hand, I can't argue that there's really strong evidence that it lowers standard of living. So to some extent, I'm saying, you know, whatever your particular – if you have a particular political opinion, you want to cherry-pick studies to support it, you can find the right studies in the area of right-to-work laws.
Is this part of the nature of economics, that it is the result of so many different factors that all sort of come together, that to find the one or two or even three things that are most definitive in terms of the cause of jobs going up or down, becomes problematic in terms of teasing it out?
Well, it is to some extent problematic. I think this is more difficult, though, than many other cases. So, for example, I've done a lot of work over the years on how state and local business taxes affect economic development. And there I think we have more of a consensus. And part of it is we simply have more variation in business taxes, variation not only across states – but across different industries or even different firms. So if you're trying to study economic development and you find that not only did a state business tax increase some state business tax change, let's say you discovered it increased the number of jobs, and let's say you discovered that it increased jobs fastest in industries that got the largest business tax reductions. Well, that's more extensive evidence than we would have for right-to-work laws. So in the case of business taxes, I think we have pretty good idea of about what the magnitude of response is. And the answer in that area is that business taxes, holding constant public service, have modest effects on economic development. And whether or not a business tax cut will on net boost economic development depends heavily on how it's financed. If it's financed in the wrong way, it can actually have a negative effect on a state's economic development. If you're reducing the quality of public services sufficiently, a business tax cut on net might have a negative effect on a state's economic development. So we actually have some pretty good ideas what those responses are. In the case of right-to-work laws, it's just a 0-1 variable. You're either right-to-work state or you're not. There hasn't been a lot of variation over time in it across the country. So our empirical evidence is just weaker than in many other areas. So I am not trying to put down my profession. I actually think in many areas we actually, contrary to what people think, economics is not all on the one hand, there's the other hand. In many cases, we do have a pretty firm consensus on what the magnitude of effects are. We have good evidence either from experiments or quasi-experiments or good control and comparison groups. In the case of right-to-work laws, it's a far more difficult than the average type of question economists are asked to answer.
I hope you don't mind me sharing a little bit from the email exchange that you and I had before we did this interview.
Sure.
You said the debate should be broader than just manufacturing jobs or just jobs in general, but also get into discussing wage rates and the mix of jobs. Do you think that that is missing from the political and policy debates over jobs and economic growth? That we seem to focus much more on the number of jobs created, the unemployment rate, and not necessarily what those jobs are providing in terms of wages and benefits?
Well, I think a lot of people miss that because – and yet we know that wage rates and the mix of jobs has major effects. I mean, in the end, I mean, if you ask what is economic development for a state economy, what are we trying to do? In my opinion, what we should be trying to do is raise the standard of living of a broad group of people in the state, the broadest possible group of state residents. Now, obviously, we do that in part by raising their employment rates, lowering unemployment, getting them into jobs. But a big part of it also is what are the wage rates of those jobs? What are the benefits? Can they support a family? Having a job that pays very, very little and can't really support a family, it's better than having no job, but it's certainly a lot worse than having a job that pays well. I was struck recently by there was an interesting interview with there was this whole dispute over Hostess Twinkies, and there was a quote from a unionized worker there who was asked, well, why would you turn down the company? The company says they're going bankrupt and they're going to go bankrupt, and you've been asked for these concessions. And, he basically said, well, a few years back, I don't remember the exact numbers, but he said a few years back we were making like $45,000 and then we made concessions and reduced it to somewhere in the $30,000 range. And now they're asking for us to reduce wages to more like in the mid-$20,000 range. And he said, it's going to be very hard for me to replace the job I used to have at Hostess. It's not going to be hard at all to replace the job they're trying to offer me. And, so his reaction was that they were essentially lowering the wage to the point where he could find another job somewhere else that would replace. That was his opinion. Whether he's right or not, I don't know. But certainly it's the case. I think everyone is aware of that, our goal is not simply to have more jobs. It is to have greater prosperity for all. whether you have a job is part of it, what the job pays is part of it, and people need to think about both of those things. They also need to think about the other point you made that came out of that email is people need to be aware of the fact that if you attract low wage, to some extent, this mixed thing, there's a trade-off here. If you're attracting low-wage employers, they are using land and labor that, in the absence of attracting those low-wage employers, would actually make your state more attractive to other employers. So you have to realize one of your resources you have is available land and labor. And, you know, there is a trade-off there that you don't necessarily – if you're attracting more low-wage employers, that means those particular industrial sites, those particular parcels of land that were zoned for industry are no longer available. And the workers employed there are no longer available. And then some other firm coming along will say, well, you know, we're not going to locate here. There doesn't seem to be enough land. The sites don't look right. We don't like the location vis-a-vis the highway, or the sites that are available don't seem attractive enough, don't have the right infrastructure in, don't have the water and sewer lines in, et cetera, et cetera.
You might find land, but the best land will probably go first to the people who get there.
Yeah, get there first. Yeah. Okay. So people need to be aware there's a trade-off there that there are some negatives. I mean, you actually could have negative effects in your economic development by attracting too many low-wage jobs. I mean, that's not necessarily a good thing. Simply more jobs, regardless of what the wage. You can run some scenarios, and I've run some scenarios. If jobs pay sufficiently low, attracting more jobs is not a long-run net plus for your economy. It's actually a negative because you've kind of squeezed out the potential for higher wage growth that might develop more jobs, better jobs later. So, you know, I think people need to be aware of that we need to be at least as concerned about the mix of jobs we're attracting as we are about the types of jobs. I mean, the other thing I would say is, what is a good job you want to attract? Well, ideally, it's a good job that pays well relative to the skills required. I mean, so another part is looking at, you know, are the companies you're attracting, not only do they pay well, but are there jobs available for people of different skill levels? And there's a little bit of a trade-off there in the sense that obviously if a firm pays high wages, on average, it's going to demand higher skills. But there's quite a bit of variation across companies in how well the jobs pay relative to what the skills they require.
Okay. Anything else we should know?
No, except as I said, I think that we need to broaden the debate on this and think more broadly about economic development than simply being a game of maximize the number of jobs you attract.
Tim Bartik, thank you for your time.
Thank you.